I'd like to introduce Rabbi Dr. Tzvi Hirsch Weinreb as our next speaker. Rabbi Weinreb has been the Executive Vice President of the Orthodox Union since January of 2002. In that role, he heads the multipurpose agency which represents and serves Orthodox Jewry throughout hundreds of synagogues across North America and beyond. Rabbi Weinreb is a talented teacher, writer, and orator, and was previously the spiritual leader of Congregation Shomrei Emunah in Baltimore, Maryland, which he joined in January 1989. Actually, shortly after, I used to attend that shul when I was at yeshiva in Baltimore. Under his leadership, the congregation grew from approximately 160 to more than 400 families. Rabbi Weinreb received his rabbinical ordination in 1962 from the Rabbi Jacob Joseph Yeshiva in New York, received his master's degree in psychology from the New School for Social Research, 1970, earned his PhD from the University of Maryland. Prior to assuming the pulpit of Congregation Shomrei Emunah, Rabbi Weinreb served as the assistant supervisor of psychological services for the Prince George's County Public Schools, as chief psychologist of the Potomac Foundation for Mental Health, and also maintained a private practice of psychotherapy. Rabbi Weinreb is vice president of the Rabbinical Council of America, past chair of its annual convention. He is rabbinic liaison for Nefesh, the North American Network of Orthodox Mental Health Professionals, is a member of the Ethics Committee of the Veterans Administration Hospitals. Rabbi Weinreb serves on the Rabbinical Council Cabinet of United Jewish Communities and on the boards of various other organizational and educational institutions. Rabbi Weinreb has been married to the former Chavi Taub since 1965. They now live on the west side of Manhattan, 3 children and 10 grandchildren. Ken Yerbu. Just before I introduce, just a brief comment on Rabbi Weinreb. This convention, we've been talking a lot of intellectual things, a lot of intellectual presentations. The other side of Jewish life is the people and the human challenges. And it's appropriate that Rabbi Weinreb speak in this final session of the afternoon, because we've seen a maturing of the Orthodox Jewish world in the past 50 years, to the point that we're not fighting for our survival as much anymore. Now the new era is an era of honesty to deal with the complexities of spousal abuse, of special education, of drug and alcohol abuse, of Israel, of community cooperation within the Orthodox world and outside of the Orthodox world. And in this, Rabbi Weinreb has brought his knowledge of both the secular and the Torah world. He's brought honesty, principles, and compassion. And for this, we've been grateful. And it's an interesting statement of the future of the Orthodox world that he is heading the Orthodox Union with all of his work in dealing with people and the challenges of all of us as Jews and all the challenges the modern world presents. It's an honor to introduce Rabbi Weinreb to address the topic of Can One Be a Zionist in the Diaspora?
Thank you very much, Rabbi Tradverts, for your introduction. If my mother, may she be well, was here, she may have believed it all. I don't know if anyone else here does. My wife has insisted that the next time I send out my resume, I make sure not to put down the dates of my various degrees, because they tip you off as far as my age. I mean, they go back 30 more years in some cases. It's a pleasure to be here in Toronto, where I have some connections. I have a son-in-law from Toronto. I'd like to begin by sharing with you 3 assumptions which I make, and then, as time allows, to discuss why I make these assumptions and what we can do about it. The first assumption is that we, as a North American Jewish community, have failed, at least so far, in properly educating our children, our young people, particularly of college age, and ourselves, adults, as to the importance of Eretz Yisrael and Medinas Yisrael, as to the importance of the land of Israel and the state of Israel, both its political, strategic importance, and its religious, spiritual importance. My second assumption is that there are two aspects of Israel, the land of Israel, that need to be taught and can be taught. One has to do with Israel as a place of refuge for a Jewish people, which is still beset by enemies of all kinds. And the second aspect has to do with the religious significance of Eretz Yisrael. If one was going to construct a list of the top five values of our religion, I don't think that you could be accurate with such a list unless you included Eretz Yisrael as one of the top five values in our religion, right up there with Shabbos and Talmud Torah. I don't have to prove that assumption. Just open up the Chumash, as we will in a moment, to the first Rashi in Chumash. Just pay attention this week as we prepare to read the beginning of the rendezvous of Avraham Avinu and the Ribono Shel Olam, and it all begins and takes place only in the context of Eretz Yisrael. And the third assumption I make is that at this particular juncture of Jewish history, in these terrible and unprecedented times, when the Jewish people are either at a point in which true disaster looms, or we are in a point where we will see the greatest of triumphs imaginable. At this juncture in Jewish history, the belief, the truly educated Jew, educated as to the importance of Eretz Yisrael, is a strategic tool, a weapon in our arsenal. And that if we fail to really understand the importance of Israel in our lives, we are not merely failing in a mitzvah or in a piece of the Jewish action. We are exposing ourselves to strategic danger and to an existential threat. These are my assumptions. We have failed to educate ourselves about the importance of Israel. There are two aspects of this importance, both very important, political and religious. And at this point in history, it is no longer just a very nice value to learn, but it is a question of our very survival, whether or not we seriously take into our beings and into our lives the land of Israel, the state of Israel. I'd like to elaborate these assumptions. First of all, some of you were here for the presentation by Rabbi Schiller just before, and he confessed, I guess publicly, to occasionally seeing a movie or watching television. I think these days it's impossible not to watch television. I'm not saying one should or must, but it's impossible with all the news, especially the news that concerns us directly in Eretz Yisrael and across the world. So I can recall not once, not twice, but six or seven times seeing, after some event of the past 2 years, a horrible bus bombing, an attack in Gaza which killed several civilians along with a terrorist chieftain, where reporters go around to various places to interview the common folk. And often they choose to interview young Jews, either on the campuses or on the place where young religious Jews, observant Jews, Orthodox Jews congregate, pizza shops. And a television reporter interviews these young people and interviews them about Israel and uses phrases like occupied territories and the common language that we all hear. And I'm amazed as to how inept these young people are when it comes to answering these simple questions. How ignorant they are, not only about the fact that there is a mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, not even a fact that, as I'll try to argue a little bit later on, our entire Torah can be understood only in terms of the relationship of the Jewish people to the land of Israel. But they don't even have the vaguest clue about the recent history of Israel, about the history of Zionism, about the return to Eretz Yisrael that goes back 200 years to the Talmidim of the Baal Shem Tov and the disciples of the Vilna Gaon. They don't know about the Balfour Declaration. They don't know about the Hakamas HaMedina. They don't know about the Six-Day War. These things are, if at best, facts that they've memorized for an exam, but certainly not things that they've internalized, and certainly not things that they can speak about with any degree of intelligence. And so we are farshemt. We are embarrassed time and time again by this ignorance. And we ask ourselves, what schools did these people go to that they have emerged so ignorant? Sometimes we find out that they've gone to schools where Eretz Yisrael has not been on the agenda in any way, shape, manner, or form. Or they've gone to schools, centrist schools, modern Orthodox schools, where it is on the agenda, but only as, you know, on Yom HaAtzmaut, we wave the flag and recite Hallel, or whatever. But it hasn't been internalized as an important piece of our religion, just as important as Shabbos and Torah. And it has not been taught to them in a way that they can intelligently answer the kinds of questions which their counterpart in the Muslim community here in North America can answer fluently. Speak to the Arab Americans, Canada or the United States, on the campuses, and they are fluent in their version of history. They are quick to be able to respond clearly, articulately, and forcefully, and convincingly about their perspective on the entire matter. And we, the so-called most intelligent and most fluent of peoples, stammer and babble and have nothing to say. And this is something that has to be corrected. It must be corrected because truth must be taught. And it has to be corrected because if it's not corrected, then we're in for some difficult, difficult times. I can come back to that point, but I'd like to get into some Torah and to just look a bit at the Torah's perspective on these topics. And I'm not going to even preach what's come to be called religious Zionism. I'm just going to talk values and facts which are l'kula alma, which no one will disagree with, no one can disagree with, because they're apparent and obvious. Can't be two points of view on this. We all know, it's not been so long ago, barely a week, that we read Parshas Bereishis. And we know Bereishis begins with a story of the creation, and Rashi asks the question, why are we starting the Torah with a story of the creation? We should start the Torah with the first mitzvah in the Torah, Chodesh HaZelochem. We should start with Parshas Bo. Why do we need all of this history of the beginnings of the world? What's the assumption that Rashi is making by asking this question? He is assuming that the Torah is a book of mitzvahs, no more. If you make that assumption, the Torah is a book of laws, then his question makes sense. The Torah is a book of laws. Begin with law number one. Why begin with stories that go on and on and on and on about God's creating the world, etc.? Begin with the first mitzvah. It's a book of laws. It's interesting, less well known than the famous Rashi, is that the Ramban says this is no question. Because, of course, the Torah had to begin with a statement about the creation, because it's basic to our belief system that there is a creator. And the Torah has to tell us about there being a creator. What's the assumption that the Ramban makes about the Torah? It's not a book of just laws. Ramban's assumption is it's a book about theology. It's a book about beliefs. It's a book about philosophy. And therefore, one has to introduce at the very beginning the notion of a creator, of an all-powerful God who created the world, etc. So we have the Ramban's assumption about what the Torah is. And that is that it's a philosophy book, maybe a law book as well. We have Rashi's initial assumption about what the Torah is, and that is it's a book of only mitzvahs. It's a law book. It's Shulchan Aruch. And therefore Rashi asks this question, why start with the story of creation? But then Rashi answers an interesting answer, which we're familiar with, and that is that the Torah begins with Bereishis, Koach Ma'asof Higid Liyamo, because the Torah wants to emphasize that the entire universe, the entire cosmos is God's. All the continents on earth are God's. All the lands in the world are God's. And therefore, he could take this land called Eretz Yisrael and take it from the Canaanim, the Amorim, the Pelishtim, and give it to the Jewish people. It's up to him. Now Rashi is doing something very strange here, because by answering that way, he's changing his whole assumption about what the Torah is all about. Because if the Torah is all about a book of laws, he hasn't answered his question. If the Torah is all about a book of laws, why do we have to be told that the Torah begins with the story of creation to legitimize our possession of the land of Israel? What does that have to do with laws? The answer is that Rashi has changed his assumption from his question to his answer. And in his answer, he makes a new assumption. And that is that Torah is not a book about God, the Creator, as the Ramban would have it. It's not a book about mitzvos, as Rashi first believed. But rather, it's a book which is written to testify to the fact that the land of Israel belongs to the Jewish people. That's his final conclusion. And therefore, the entire Torah unfolds as a history of the relationship of the Jewish people to the Jewish land. Think about it that way. You can now carry through from Bereishis, through all of the Chumash, through all of the Nevi'im, and even through most of the Kesuvim, and you will understand every aspect of Tanakh as being one thing and one thing only, a description of the relationship of the Jewish people to the land of the Jewish people. Megillas Esther, just to pick something at random. It's a story, a beautiful story about Esther and Mordechai and everything, etc. But it's really a story about how vulnerable the Jewish people are when they're not in their own land. When they are at the mercy of foolish kings and scheming viziers. On and on. Take any book of Tanakh. Take Tehillim. Take any kapitel Tehillim. When Tehillim speaks of Oretz, shouldn't translate it land with a small L, but land with a capital L, because land means the land of Israel. Take your pick. Yeshaya, Yirmiyah, Amos, Yonah. Any sefer you want in Tanakh. It's all understood now in terms of Rashi's conclusion in the first Rashi and Chumash, and that is what the Torah is. It's not a book of laws. It's not a book of teachings. Not just a book of laws. Not just a book of teachings. Not just a book of theology. The Bible, the Old Testament, what's it all about? It's about the relationship of the land of Israel and the people of Israel. And it's a tortuous relationship. And it continues on and on after Tanakh closed to this very day. This is a lesson which Christians understand better today than Jews understand. How many of you, I went as one of the organizers of the big rally in Washington back in middle April. Tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of people came, Jews mostly, but there were some non-Jews. And the non-Jews had signs which said, Israel belongs to the Jews. How do I know? The Bible tells me so. I didn't see everyone in that crowd. Baruch Hashem was too big of a crowd. But I didn't see any Jewish kids with that statement. How do I know? The Bible tells me so. But I saw Christians from these various fundamentalist Pentecostal Christian groups with that sign. How do I know? The Bible tells me so. Because they understand that the Bible tells us about this kesher, this bond of the Jewish people and the land of Israel. In this week's parsha, well, the very end of last week's parsha, we read an interesting thing. We read about the birth of Avram and his brothers. And we read about Avram's father, Terach. We read about Avram's marriage to Sarai, and Nochor's marriage to Milcah, and Haran's death, and Haran's son, Lot, who's Avram's nephew. And they all live as a happy family, we presume, in Ur Kasdim. And out of the blue, Terach gets up and takes Avram and Lot and Sarai and leaves Ur Kasdim lo leches arzo Canaan. Leaves Ur Kasdim in order to go to the land of Canaan, to the land of Eretz Yisrael. Vayavo at Choron, they come down, they're marching southwest, and they come down from Ur Kasdim, which is somewhere, Mesopotamia, wherever that is, northern Iran. And they come down toward Choron. And they stopped there. What was Terach? Why did Terach want to go to Canaan? Why did he leave Ur Kasdim? Now, there are Midrashim, which we're familiar with. And the Midrashim all boil down to one thing. Terach didn't hear any voice from God saying, the land of Israel is holy. He didn't hear anything like that. Terach just got up out of the blue and went to the land of Israel. Perhaps because of religious persecution. Terach started to believe, as his son Avram believed, in monotheism. It was very dangerous to believe in monotheism in Ur Kasdim, so he decided to leave, but he didn't flee north, didn't flee due south, he didn't flee, he went toward Eretz Yisrael, never got there. But his goal was Eretz Canaan. Eretz Canaan for him was a refuge, a political refuge. Perhaps the economy was bad in Ur Kasdim, and he heard that there's a land down there that's Zavas Cholav Udvash, flowing with milk and honey. Perhaps it was for economic reasons. Who knows? Perhaps it was for health reasons. He had asthma. The climate was better in a drier climate. We don't know. But we're not told that he went for any religious reason. He just went for any one of a variety of reasons. It's open to your guess after the speculation or the special insights of Chazal. But that was the very last pasuk in last week's parsha. We often forget last week's parsha is behind us. This week's parsha is like it comes on a new scene. In a new scene, God speaks to Avram in Choron and tells him, Lech lecha, leave Choron, and go el ha'oretz asher arecha, and go to the land which we know, he didn't know yet, but was Eretz Yisrael. So he's not going out of Choron because there's anything bad in Choron. Nimrod and the persecutors are in Ur Kasdim. He's gone. Choron on a map is hundreds of miles southwest of Ur Kasdim. So he's safe. Choron, as far as we know, is a very prosperous place. After all, Lavan seems to do quite well there, materially. And so why didn't Avram stay in Choron? Avram has one reason. God said, leave Choron and go to Ha'aretz Asher Areka. So Avram's reason for going is purely religious, a response to the will of God. So we have in the nexus of the end of last week's parsha and the beginning of this week's parsha two motives for going to Eretz Yisrael. Terach's motive, which is not religious, just practical, and Avram's motive, which might be the above, but also in addition, is response to the will of God. And if we approach things this way, we answer many, many questions. And I ask you, as you study and prepare for this coming Shabbos, to look at Lech Lecha and Vayera from this dual perspective. Avram goes as a son of Terach, not as a Jew, as a son of Terach to Israel. He's not going out of religious reasons. He's not a religious Zionist. He's going to Zion for all sorts of reasons. To escape the ghetto of Ur Kasdim. To escape the persecution of Ur Kasdim. For whatever reason. But not religious reasons on the one hand. But he's also going in response to God's will. And then we can understand, you can open the Chumash, the very beginning. One pasuk says, Vayelech Avram. Avram went. Ka'asher diber elov Hashem. He went in response to God's command. Number one. And number two. Vayikach Avram es Sora Yishto, v'yes Lot Benoche, v'yes Kol Ruchushom, etc., v'yes Hanefesh. Vayetzu lo leches arzo Kanaan. And he went toward Eretz Kanaan. Why does the Torah have to tell you in the opening Pesukim of Lech Lecha twice that he went? The answer is he went once, Ka'asher Diber Elov Hashem. He went once for religious reasons. And he went again. He was multiply determined. He had two motivations. He went again as his father went, with Sorai, with Lot, Vayetzu Loleches Arzo Kanaan. Those are exactly the words of last week's Parsha, how Terach went. Vayetzu Loleches Arzo Kanaan. The only difference is, whereas Terach stopped in Choron, Avram continued Vayovo Arzo Kanaan. He arrived there. And this, you know, the Ramban teaches us, and it's so important. Ma'ase avos simon labonim. The Ramban says that what happens in Chumash Bereishis as the story unfolds, beginning this week and unfolds over the next weeks, the whole story becomes recapitulated in Jewish history. The history of the Jewish people is encapsulated in Ma'ase avos, in the stories of the patriarchs and the matriarchs. What happened to Avram and Sarah happens to us all. It happened to them 4,500 years ago. It happens to us today. There's two reasons to go to Eretz Yisrael. There's Terach's reason to escape whatever there is in the Golos. And there is the religious reason in response to Lech Lecha Me'artzecha U'mimolaltecha Me'beis Avicha. Rav Kook, in his writings, emphasizes that one should not go to Eretz Yisrael. One should not think of Israel because of category one, but only category two. He writes that Eretz Yisrael eino inyan chitzoni. It is not an external matter. It's not a peripheral matter. It's not just for economic reasons, for socioeconomic reasons, for political reasons, but rather it's the will of God. But these are two dimensions of Eretz Yisrael that still factor in today. That still factor in today. And we have to teach ourselves, and we have to teach our children, particularly our children who are on the campuses of this world, particularly in English-speaking countries, because in countries that speak other languages are not even listened to. But in countries which speak English, at least they still have a voice, but their voice is inarticulate. You have to teach them these two messages. The political reality of why Israel is so important to us, and the religious, spiritual reality of why Israel must be so important to us. We have to teach them the Chumash, we have to teach them the words of Nevi'im, we have to teach them the words of the Gemara, and the fact that the Amoroyim, when they came to Eretz Yisrael, they fell on the ground and kissed the ground. We have to teach this to our children. At the same time that we have to teach them from such books as Myth and Facts, or a beautiful book by a woman named Joan Peters called From Time Immemorial, which is no religious agenda, but just gives you the facts, the historical, realpolitik facts about why our claim to the land of Israel is just, and a whole other literature that I can remember. And I tell you, I, for a number of years, used to say a shir in Gemara, Daf Yomi, in a little shtiebel in Baltimore. We're at that point, they've almost all passed away now, it's 20 years ago, where almost all of the Talmidim were older than me, much older than me, and they were Yiddish-speaking Hungarian Jews who fled Hungary, who went through the Gehenna of the Shoah, and came to these shores and ended up in Baltimore. And these were wonderful people. And I remember teaching them Daf Yomi, and of course, the education of these people was interrupted. When the war, World War II broke out, Hitler invaded their countries, their regions, they were 16 years old, 15 years old, 17 years old, 12 years old. So their education was interrupted at that point. But they still had a solid education, the kind of education that only a Hungarian Jew in the old country had. But part of that education was a vicious anti-Zionist teaching, which was extremely strong, extremely strong. So this was in their blood. This is what they were taught. And I remember teaching them, learning Maseches Ksuvos, at the beginning of Maseches Ksuvos, it's all Lomdische Gemaras about Ksuvos, about the relationship, marriage documents, etc., etc. And then you reach toward the end of Maseches Ksuvos, and you have these three or four pages in praise of the land of Israel. And you read that if a person doesn't live in the land of Israel, it's as if he has no God. And that's been interpreted a thousand different ways. But that's what the words mean, what I just said. If you live outside of Eretz Yisrael, you got no God. All right? You can interpret it all kinds of pilpulim. But that's what it says. And Rav Abba have a Menashe Kippur de Yako. Rav Abba, when he reached the stones of Akko, coming down from the north, first city along the coast that was bona fide Eretz Yisrael that he met, came to, was Akko. So he got down and kissed the rocks. All right. I was teaching this to these men, and they thought, Skenishdan, Skenishdan, the Gemurah, the other can the Gemurah, the Zugen. All right? Because they were, I hate to say it, they were brainwashed with a different perspective, and they were not open to Mefurasha, explicit passages in the Talmud. But of course, the Talmud, you know, you've got to turn the pages to find it. But you don't have to turn the pages very far in Chumash Bereshis to find the importance of Eretz Yisrael. What I hate to say is that in our time, in the yeshiva world, in the world of Jewish education, and I'm not talking about the far right, I'm talking about moderate yeshivos, what's come to predominate in our time, especially of all times in the past 2 years, has been the shita of the Satmar Rav. Zecher Tzadik Livracha. I'm not here to denigrate the Satmar Rav or to denigrate his shita, but it's only one shita. But you speak today to young yeshiva boys or yeshiva girls, especially in the year or two in Eretz Yisrael, depending upon which yeshiva they're sent to, but in the yeshiva where I bet most of the children of mainstream Toronto go to, they are being taught that of course we're having trouble now with the Arabs and the Intifada because we've defied God by coming to this land, by setting up our own state, by doing so against the will of the nations. And we violated the three oaths that the Gemara speaks about not going to Israel too soon. That's one point of view. But when I went to yeshiva, it was considered, and I went to a right-wing yeshiva, but then that was considered to be gore right-wing, extreme, Satmar extremism. It's now mainstream because it's an easy answer, theologically, to a questioning sophomore who wants to know, why are you suffering so? You know, God should be on our side, chase all the Arabs out of Israel, everything should be fine. Well, we're suffering so, we must be doing something wrong. So we must be doing something wrong. Is the fact that we set up a state, a Jewish state, prematurely. We're going against God's design. There are other points of view, and the most articulate and eloquent one, especially one to confront a yeshiva-educated young man or young woman, is with a work called Eim Habonim Semecha, a work written by a bona fide Hungarian Gadol Batorah, who was originally a disciple of the Munkacsarov, of the Minchas Elazar, who believed too fiercely in anti-Zionism until the Shoah broke out. And then instead of saying this Shoah is a punishment for our sins of Zionism, said it's punishment for our sins of not being Zionistic enough, of not going. You have to read this work. It's translated into English. There were actually two translations of it into English. I forget the names of the translators, but Rabbi Wein, in a review essay in a recent issue of Jewish Action, which is the OU's magazine, has a review of both translations of Eim Habonim Semecha. Obviously, the translations differ a bit, but they both get the point across. And he, of course, marshals sources from Torah Nevi'im Uksuvim, sources from Chazal, Shas, Bavli, Yerushalmi, etc., etc., and from the Gedolei Hadoros, from the early Rishonim, from the Ramban, right through the Baal Shem Tov and the Gara, through the Gedolim of the 20th century, Rav Meir Simcha, the Chofetz Chaim, etc., all whom were for Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, in one form or another. Extremely important stuff, and I'm afraid, you know, this audience is nodding, so you've heard this message, you know it, but it has to be heard by others in the mainstream Jewish community. We have failed to teach what we need to teach. There are two aspects to it. And now, the third piece. This talk that I'm giving now is not just a good talk about Zionism and the importance of Eretz Yisrael, etc. That's piece of cake. What's much more important is a man who today sits in southern Lebanon and is supported by the regimes of Syria and Iran. While we are all being distracted by Iraq, there are two other mean-spirited countries, part of the axis of evil that President Bush spoke of a year ago, September. And they are Syria and Iran, and they support a movement called the Hezbollah, who probably at this very moment are in one way or another doing their mischief to our brothers and sisters in northern Eretz Yisrael. And the leader of the Hezbollah is a sheikh, a sheikh, and his name is Sheikh Nasrallah. Very, very bright man. One of the things we tend to do is to underestimate the intelligence, the shrewdness, the creativity, the dedication, the commitment, and the brilliance of our Arab enemies. They are all of the above. Sometimes more so than we are. Jews have a reputation for being the smartest people on earth. You know, I don't think so. We're not so smart. But our enemies are very smart. And Sheikh Nasrallah is one of the people who really incited the now two years plus old Intifada war. And he did so because of what he calls the theory of the spider web. That's the word that he used. I don't know how you say spider web in Arabic. Spider web. He says, Israel, the state of Israel, the Jewish state of Israel, is a spider web. It looks strong, but it's very weak. Test it out, and it'll just fall apart. He saw that happen under his eyes when there was a unilateral withdrawal from Lebanon, one of the more brilliant moves of a former prime minister. Unilateral withdrawal from Lebanon. So what was the lesson that the Hezbollah learned? You shoot enough Jews, you bother them enough, they're not going to have the spine, the backbone to stick it out. They're going to run. And he just took that lesson that he learned in southern Lebanon and extrapolated it to all of Eretz Yisrael, all of Medina Yisrael. He said, blow up enough buses, shoot enough kindergartners, invade enough yeshivas and shoot young men in the Beis Medrash, and all the other horrors that we've seen over the past 2 years, Baruch Hashem, they've decreased in frequency, but they still occur daily in one way or another. Do enough of that, and the whole thing is going to collapse and they're going to fall apart. And the truth is that many, many people believed him, and not just our enemies. There's a man who is a great Ohev Yisrael, truly great Eretz Yisrael, Ohev Yisrael. He loves Jews. And he's a Roman Catholic priest, very high. I'm blocking on his name right now, but he's the editor of a magazine called First Things. Very articulate spokesman for the Catholic Church. And he loves the people of Israel. He loves the Jewish people. There are such people. And he's proved it over his life in various ways. But he wrote a major article about a year ago in First Things where he said, you know, the Jewish people are not going to stick it out. They're going to fold up and leave. And he predicted, you know, soon we're going to see an exodus from Israel. Who's going to stay under these kinds of conditions? And there are many who predicted the same type of thing. And Baruch Hashem, we've seen the reverse. That Kasha Yana Oso, Ken Yirbeva, Ken Yifrots, we've learned the lesson from our ancestors in Egypt. The worse we're treated, the stronger we get. The more terrorism, the more resolve. Now that's true in Eretz Yisrael and a great sector of the population. But it's got to be true for all Jews across the world. We all have to have that dedication, no matter where we live. Now, I don't know where the subtitle came from that was given on the program. Can you be a Zionist in the diaspora? You can be a Zionist in the diaspora if you have the commitment, the dedication to all of these principles that I'm mentioning today. And you speak about it wherever you have to speak, whether it's letters to the editor, whether it's on the internet and cyberspace, whether it's on the college campus, whether it's in the local high school, wherever it is. It's a beautiful poem by an old Israeli poet, Natan Alterman, where he writes about a dialogue between the Satan and the innocent Jewish soul. And Satan says, you know, let him have whatever he wants, this innocent Jewish soul. I know how I'll get him in the end. I'll make him forget Shehatzedek Ito. I'll make him forget that his cause is just. This is the danger we face right now. If we forget that our cause in Eretz Yisrael is a just cause, and it's just, obviously, internally it's just because we believe in a creator who gave us this land. But externally it's just because of all the historical reasons that we can offer for why this land belongs to us, why it's ours. And not just the pre-67 borders, but what's called in the by our enemies' occupied territories, and what's called by ourselves the West Bank, because we forget to call it by its proper name, Yehuda v'Shomron. And the truth is, there's something which we're not even thinking about now on the east side of the Jordan, which is also ours, Eva Hayarden. But we have to think, not just because the Bible tells us so, but because history tells us so. Because your Bubby and your Zaidi, when they were in Russia or in Poland or wherever they came from in Germany, had a little blue box, a little pushkala, Keren Kayemis, and they put in their hard-earned groschen or kopecks or whatever they had. Or if they were in this country, they put in their pennies and nickels, I remember my great-grandmother doing. And they sent that money to Keren Kayemis that bought those lands, much of them, for hard-earned dollars by the Jewish people across the world. Because those people, my Bubby and your Bubby, they understood Shehatzedek Itanu. They knew without their education and without their college degrees and everything, they knew that this land was ours. I invite you, the next time you visit Israel, it was an eye-opener for me, to go into the offices of Keren Kayemet. They're right there in the center of downtown Yerushalayim. The offices of Jewish National Fund, and look at some of the documents that they have of the title to some of the places that they own. Do you know that the JNF owns land in Syria? What is today Syria? What is today Lebanon? Because when in 1902 my great-grandmother was contributing to JNF, Palestine included a big chunk of what is today southern Syria and a very big chunk of what is today Jordan. So there are pieces of land that we own. You know, straight out right, that were bought by my Elta Baba's pennies. Right? I'm just giving one example of a kind of a fact that we don't know about, most of us. But we have to teach these facts, learn these facts, and speak out these facts. If we don't, then Sheikh Nasrallah is right. We're just a spider web, and we're going to fall apart. What gives us backbone, what gives us courage, is only Shehatzedek Itanu. An army cannot fight, no matter how well equipped it is, if it doesn't believe Shehatzedek Itanu. This is a problem that the Tzahal faces right now, because many young soldiers just don't feel that their cause is just. And they have to be taught or retaught, re-educated. And that's happening. That's happening in a big way. But we have to do it again and again, as much as we can. So these are just some thoughts about the importance of the land of Israel today. I just return to my three initial assumptions, which I now repeat with more force. We have failed to teach ourselves and our children about the importance of the land and the state of Israel. However, we can do better and we will do better. We're beginning to do better. There are two aspects of Eretz Yisrael that are important to remember: the political, economic, military, and the religious, spiritual. And they're both important. And when you study the rest of this Chumash Bereishis, beginning this week's Parsha on, tune in to those two forces both working. And number three, that this dedication, this conviction that we have to have, is not only important for religious reasons and for morale building, it's important strategically and existentially in order that we survive as a people in this world. And we have difficult enemies and difficult enemies across the world, but we've learned long ago that with the conviction of Hatzedek Itonu, we can prevail. I'm going to stop here and just encourage you to comment or ask questions or go to dinner. What's the program?
Questions from the microphone. 1 minute. 1 minute.
1 minute. All right. Who talks fast?
Until we turn the tape off.
Until we turn the tape. I told them to turn the tape off. I want to say this. I didn't come here on behalf of my organization of the Orthodox Union, although we're very, very much involved in various projects toward the ends that I just enunciated. But if you're interested in knowing what you can do for Israel, and you want a list of practical things that you can do, each and every one of you, I suggest you go to the OU's website and look for a list of items. There are now about, several dozen items, what you can do for Israel. The OU's website is, simple enough, www.ou.org.
Is this on? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. As you know, as we all know, the anti-Semitism in France... Is that better? Okay. As we know, the anti-Semitism in France is unfortunately growing by leaps and bounds. I'll give you a point in example. My children live in Ramat Beit Shemesh, and they've just built a new development that's called the French Village, because they expect a tremendous number of French Jews to leave France and come to Eretz Yisrael. How long do you think it'll take before it happens here? Personally, I don't think it'll be more than 10 years.
It's a very good question. I hope to speak tonight the challenges that face Jewish people, and one big one, of course, is anti-Semitism. France is up there. The most recent survey of the French population ranked, after Iraq, the most dangerous country to civilization, Israel. This is a recent poll, so I'm fully familiar with the problem and with the increased aliyah from France. Obviously, if people leave to escape French anti-Semitism, that's wonderful, but that's a perfect example of Terach's reasons. That's not Avram's reasons, but you know, one way or another, they're getting there. I am not a prophet. I don't predict things about the future. I try very, very much, especially in my new position, to be very, very responsible and to only say things which I can say with a certain degree of certainty, which are based upon facts, observations, etc. So I just don't want to speculate on those kinds of things. What I will say is, and the whole topic of anti-Semitism, as I'll say, many forests have been felled and many seas of ink have been consumed to explain the phenomenon of anti-Semitism. So many books written about it, from ancient Rome to Jean-Paul Sartre to contemporary thinkers of all kinds. And no one's really been able to figure it out and explain it. You know, the fact that anti-Semitism is on the rise in France, all right, a lot of Jews in France. There always were Jews in France. Well, they have a history, whatever. They're next door to Germany. They have from whom to learn anti-Semitism. France once was a very Catholic country. So they have that heritage of anti-Semitism to be proud of, etc. But anti-Semitism is on the rise in Japan. All right? Anti-Semitism is on the rise in Indonesia. All right? Wherever. I mean... There are very few Jews in Japan. Japan has no history and no, it's not a Christian country, etc. Where did that come from? I don't know the answer to that, except there I can share with you a beautiful essay by the Netziv. Netziv Mevalojin, whose works are, I feel, underestimated. People say a little vertlach on the parsha from the Netziv, but they don't realize Netziv was a prophet in his time. And he wrote an essay about anti-Semitism. He uses the word anti-Semitism, interestingly enough, which was a new word, because Netziv died in 1892. I don't know exactly when he wrote this essay, but it must have been the 1870s, 1880s. And he uses the word anti-Semitism. It's called Sha'or Yisrael, and it's to be found together with a little booklet with his commentary on Shir HaShirim. But it's also translated into English by a Canadian rabbi, Rabbi Howard Joseph. Some of you may know. The last time I gave the speech, he was in the audience. He said, I know him. And I met him for the first time. He did a beautiful job of translating this essay of Netziv. And it's called, he calls it in English, The Remnant of Israel. It's published by Jason Aronson Press. It's a must read. Jason Aronson Press. It's a press many of us know. If you can't get a big publisher to publish your writings, so you go to Jason Aronson and they'll publish it. There's no put down of Mr. Joseph, Rabbi Joseph. He did a wonderful job, but the world doesn't recognize such things often. But he did a beautiful job translating it with interesting notes. But Netziv, it boils down to one thing. He said anti-Semitism always was and always will be. Sometimes Ribbono Shel Olam lets it out of the Pandora's box, and sometimes he stuffs it into the Pandora's box, but it's always there. And when one wonders about anti-Semitism, one has to think of it in terms of Hester upon him and Ha'oras upon him, of God hiding his face or shining his face. When he shines his face, anti-Semitism is contained. When he hides his face, it crawls out from under the rocks. And now I'm afraid we're in a time when it's really crawling out from under the rocks wherever you go. How likely is it to happen in Canada? I don't know. Or the United States? I don't know. But we have to always be on the lookout for it and watch for it and be careful, etc.
I just wanted to say that in my experience, there are a lot of French people already that have made Aliyah. When I was in Israel, I met many, many people, both religious and non-religious. You can't hear, sorry. My experience being in Israel in the last couple of years is there's already a lot of people coming from France, both religious and non-religious. But what I wanted to ask you, there was a prominent rabbi that came to speak here from Israel, and he was saying that if a critical mass of American Jews were to decide to come and live in the Shomrim, especially near Shechem, that this would, in fact, be what is needed to make Hashem respond.
Yeah, I mean, there's no question about it. I remember when I, in the opening days of the Oslo peace process, so I was anti-Oslo from the beginning, Baruch Hashem, Ribbono Shel Olam gave me a little bit of seichel to see what it turned out to be way back. So I led various protests to different places, embassies. And someone, one Sunday, we were protesting across the country, and I was leading a protest in front of the Israeli embassy in Washington. But a friend of mine was leading a protest in front of the Israeli consulate in Chicago. So the head of the Israeli consulate in Chicago at that point was a dati, a fellow with a kippah. And he came out and said, what are you protesting for? If 50,000 Jews from Chicago would make Aliyah this week, it'd solve the whole problem. That's, you know, at that point, this is 10 years ago, now you're maybe a little more than 50,000. You know, you may have read last week the United Jewish Communities Federations released a population study, which I hope to allude to tonight a bit. The main finding of the population study is this. If you study a random group of human beings and plot how many of them are below 10 years old, below 20 years old, below 30 years old, below 70 years old, you'll get a triangle, right? Most of the people in the group are below 10. Then, as time goes on, there's mortality, et cetera. As age goes up, the triangle narrows and narrows. For the Jewish people of North America, the chart is not, it's not a triangle. It's a diamond. It starts very small, increases at age 40, baby boomers, then narrows again. All right? So So that's more frightening than anti-Semitism. The Semitism, you know, we'll do what we have to do. Here, what we have to do is have more Jewish babies. That's what it all boils down to. However, the interesting thing is when you, I say, take a random group of human beings and make the chart, you'll almost always get a triangle, except with North American Jews. But how is that triangle? Sometimes a triangle is this type of triangle, sometimes it's that type of triangle. For Palestinians, it's this type of triangle, all right? Because their birth rate is far greater than our birth rate. For North American Jews, it's not even a triangle, it's a diamond, it's an inverted triangle halfway up. For Israeli Jews, it's a solid triangle, but the Palestinian triangle is much, the base is much wider, because their birth rate is much stronger. And that's, you know, I hate to say that things boil down to demographics, but go to Eretz Yisrael, as I do pretty regularly over the past some years, every 6 months, and you'll always see more Arab building and more Arab building and more Arabs and more Arabs and more Arabs, even in places that are bona fide Israel by everyone. So, I mean, look in Yerushalayim. You know, I remember a few years ago, you stood in Har HaZeisim and the Arab villages were way in the distance. Now the Arab villages are right under Har HaZeisim. You visit the poor Yishuvim in on the Gaza Strip, Kfar Darom, etc. So there was a time when, what's just south of Kfar Darom, is Khan Yunis or one of those Arab cities, there was a time when it was in the distance. Now it's right smack up against the Jewish perimeters. So that's much more frightening than anti-Semitism, and we can pray for a decrease in the Arab birth rate, but I don't know what we can do about it. But we can do something about the Jewish birth rate. Some of us can do something about it.
Rabbi, you spoke earlier about campus problems. We have one here in Canada, located at Concordia University in Montreal, which is the most hateful and detestable congregation of Arabs and Palestinians and general anti-Semites that you can find in all of Canada. And what compounds it is that I read recently that Canada allows Saudi Arabians to come into Canada without a visa, and people like you and I and people like in Israel or any or in Europe, anybody must present a visa when they come to Canada. And we are considered as one of the finest countries in the world as far as democracy is concerned. I think that the problems that the Jewish university students are undergoing is really horrendous. Would you speak on that matter, yeah, please?
First of all, the United States let in some Saudi Arabians without a visa, and they did much worse than just speak propaganda on a college campus. They killed 3,000 people. So that's certainly true. The question is, of course, what we can do about these kinds of things. And there's a number of things that we can do. There's something that we can do as groups, as the Orthodox Union, et cetera, can do. And that is to be on the college campuses, to teach our own kids, to encourage them, to support them, et cetera, to give them artillery or to fight back, to speak back. There's also something else that everybody can do as an individual, and that is that many college campuses, many big college campuses, and the one you mentioned is just an example, live very close proximity to Jewish communities. And Jewish people need to open their homes to Jewish students in a way that, first of all, gives them a little place of comfort and security, because it can be physically dangerous these days to be on a college campus, but also gives them a taste of authentic Judaism, not just with regard to feelings about Israel, but in every way. And that's something that the Jewish community across the United States and Canada has not been doing sufficiently of. I'm speaking as Chatai Ani Mazkir. In Baltimore, Washington, where I've been living for many years, there are numerous college campuses up and down the Baltimore-Washington corridor. And it's not common practice for Jews to throw the house open on Shabbos for these students. But it's something that has to be done, and it can be done very easy. You don't need a big, just need an extra couple of potatoes in the cholent, and it's doable. It's doable. The other interesting thing is, of course, that we do have to be afraid of two groups. We have to be afraid of anti-Semite stam, who may or may not be Arab, and we have to be concerned with the Arab populations in our great cities. And the interesting phenomenon, I don't know how it works in Canada, but in half a dozen cities in the States that I can think of, Arabs and Jews live mamish side by side. It's true in Brooklyn, Chicago, Detroit, a couple other cities. For whatever reason, the Palestinian Arabs and the Jewish people find us, we're very similar. We're very similar in many ways. For some reason, we go to the same areas. You go to Flatbush these days, and if people think of Flatbush as being a Jewish bastion, but go all along Flatbush, you'll see all the stores are halal meat, Arab signs, etc. This is true in Detroit and Chicago as well. Go along Devon in Chicago, you'll go from the kosher Dunkin' Donuts to the, quote, kosher, Muslim kosher, or whatever. This is an interesting phenomenon, but they are growing and we are shrinking. They are intelligent on these issues and we are not. They are passionate and we are largely indifferent. And these are things that have to change.
Is there a last question? Okay, is there a formal program with the OU or with Rabbanim generally across North America to push for Aliyah on a regular basis? I mean, obviously every shul supports Israel. Every shul's got huge. You know what I mean. But I mean, I have found in my experience that, with certain exceptions, that Rabbanim shy away from pushing their congregants on a regular basis to push the idea that they should make plans for Aliyah. Is there such a thing? And if there isn't, why isn't there?
There's an increased push toward Aliyah. There are various organizations that are designed for Aliyah. Tehillah is one. Nefesh B'Nefesh is another. This Nefesh B'Nefesh has been very successful. They're the ones who brought, I don't know how many hundred families last year to Eretz Yisrael, and they're planning for a bigger group this time. At least within the Orthodox Union, we're trying to put Aliyah on the agenda, back on the agenda. And we're working with various organizations that do Aliyah to support them in their efforts and to push that. The three organizations that we're working with specifically are one called Olona Aleh, where Rabbi Gold, formerly of Toronto, was very, very active in, Tehillah, and Nefesh B'Nefesh. What I find personally is that, you know, we have all kinds of Jews, all kinds, I'm talking even within the more or less observant community, who need all kinds of support systems when they make Aliyah. There's young people, there's old people, there's retirees, and there's singles, et cetera, et cetera. And these different Aliyah groups, some are more effective with one group than the other. So if you need a good shidduch when you make Aliyah to make sure you're going under the auspices that you're going to make Aliyah and stay there, because, as you know, it's a dropout rate. Part of that dropout rate is that the acclimation, the klita, is not done properly. You can't just go cold. The average, more or less observant Jew cannot just pick up and move to Israel and expect to adapt. You need preparation and you need a support system, etc. Different Aliyah groups offer different kinds of support systems. You have to talk to a maven when you do it. If you just do it blindly, idealistically, you know, maybe you'll have siyata d'shmaya, maybe you won't, but it's harder to do. If you do it, you got to do it with some type of rational plan, and then you succeed. Nefesh B'Nefesh, actually, it's interesting because when I come back from Toronto tomorrow, my first meeting is with this young man, Rabbi Fass, F-A-S-S, who's the head of Nefesh B'Nefesh, who is a visionary, really a remarkable young man. And we do work closely with him. And again, go to our website and you'll see all these various organizations listed, and we're trying to give them whatever support we can. And we'll be doing more of that because it's a very, very important priority. Okay, thanks again for listening. We'll see you tonight with some more bad news.